Turn to you. There's a couple of them over here. We're in Genesis chapter 49. As we get into our study of this chapter, you'll understand why I picked the songs I did for the early part of the service. It didn't feel very Christmassy. right? But it's appropriate for the text of Genesis chapter 49. Talk to any lawyer who's done estate work, and they will tell you that one of the most effective ways to guarantee strife and contention among your children after you die is to die without having made a detailed will. Okay. I think my brother handled two estates before he said, "This is not what I want to do in my legal career," all right? But I've seen families fracture over property disputes involving items that any outside observer would have considered worthless. Arguing over the garden hose and the rake and the hoe in the shed, you know, over who was supposed to get that stuff. Strife could usually have been avoided if there had been a family meeting in advance where the deceased had made his intentions clear. Those kind of meetings are really important, but we tend to consider those kind of conversations morbid. I suppose we like to think of ourselves as immortal, and that probably explains, at least partly explains, our reluctance to discuss final arrangements in advance, but we tend to leave them too late. It's typical. People often leave those meetings saying, you know, all those things, you know, I can imagine people beyond the grave thinking, all those things I should have said to my kids and didn't, or to my family and didn't, those kind of regrets. And I say all that because Jacob now is aware that the end of his life is approaching, and he avoids that problem, at least to some degree. This is not a last will and testament exactly. But he's got more on his mind than property distribution. A lot of the property distribution is actually going to have to be left to Joshua to deal with 450 years later, and so there's not a lot of property to distribute at this point for Jacob. In the previous chapter, Jacob had begun the process, as we saw it last time, of setting his affairs in order. He had had a semi-private ceremony involving Joseph and his two sons, designated Joseph as the recipient of the birthright, who would get a double portion of the estate, as it were, a double portion of the blessing. Unlike his father before him, Isaac, Jacob is handling the birthright and the blessing separately. Isaac tried to handle them together, and he tried to handle them in secret, and he tried to give it to the son that was not supposed to get either, which is probably why he tried to do it in secret, as I've said when we studied that portion of Genesis. Jacob has no intention of pronouncing the blessing of God upon one son in a private meeting. Even in the previous one, he designated Joseph's younger son, Ephraim, as a recipient of a greater future than his elder son, Manasseh, his firstborn, but he does it in the presence of Joseph. He explains his intentions, and both of those are things that Isaac never did. But now that the time for pronouncing the blessing has come, Jacob calls all of his sons together. So nobody is left in the dark. Everybody knows what's come. Everybody has an idea of what Jacob intends. I can't help but wonder just how much pain and turmoil Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau might have been spared if Isaac had been wise enough to handle things the way Jacob does here. But Jacob kind of learned the hard way from the way his father handled things not to do it that way as he's approaching his death. We'll look at this in sections as we go. Let's ask the Lord's blessing on our study tonight. Father, we pray that you would bless as we dig into this fascinating passage, Genesis 49. Lord, I pray that you would help us to understand, at least to get a handle on what Jacob has to say to his children and how some of these things are going to be fulfilled, at least a glimpse of it, Lord. But Lord, to appreciate both his intentions but also your hand in directing him and the evidence that you are directing their lives as you do all of our lives, Lord, and the encouragement that can give us, Lord. I pray that you would bless for having studied this passage tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. The bulk of the chapter is given to Jacob's oracle. and I call it an oracle because I think that's the best word for it. It's not his last will and testament, but it's more prophetic. The content of the message in letter A, verses 41 and 42, then Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father." So he's called them together and he's reciting what must have been a laboriously prepared poem, because this is in poetic form starting with verse 2. Okay, this is a poem all the way through verse 28, it's a poem all the way through verse 27. It's in poetic form with prophetic statements about each of his sons, so it's prophetic in nature. That's why I called it an oracle, okay? It's a carefully prepared poem. You ever have to write a poem for English class? It's stressful because I'm not a connoisseur of poetry. I ask that question, I get two parents looking at Elliot. Like maybe there's an assignment pending. Just finished it. Okay. And I'm sure you loved it and would love to share your poem with the whole group. I'm not gonna ask you to do that. Oh no. Poetry is challenging, all right, in any language, and we've got the Psalms. We know something of Hebrew poetry. We've got Proverbs, which is mostly poetic. We have other examples. It's easy to overlook places like this. Poetry is challenging to write. Now, Hebrew wasn't quite as concerned about rhythm and rhyme as English poetry tends to be, but it's more about thoughts and parallelisms of ideas or contrasts of ideas and structure. So there are rules for it and how it's constructed, and it takes effort to compose. You say, well, didn't he write under the inspiration of the Spirit? Sure, but the Spirit used his intellect and his efforts in the process, and superintended to make sure what he wrote is what he intended, what God intended to be written. And Jacob is self-consciously God-guided in this. He's aware that he's speaking prophetic oracle as he's writing this. But this is not something that he prepared in an afternoon. This is not something he threw together by writing down some ideas on the back of an envelope to share with his kids. He has worked hard on this, and it's probably taken months to prepare this particular poem. He's addressing them in more or less birth order. There's a couple of them who come out of order for reasons that are never explained. And he starts with the sons of Leah. Then he proceeds through the sons of the handmaids and concludes with the sons of Rachel. All of the prophecies seem to have had at least a degree of temporal fulfillment in the future history of Israel, things that that have been, at least to a degree, have been fulfilled already. Sometimes partial, sometimes obscure, sometimes even unidentifiable ways that they may have been fulfilled historically. We've got to keep in mind that Jacob's emphasis is consciously on the eschatological future of his family, fulfillment in the kingdom yet to come. He says in verse 1, at the end of verse 1, that these are things that which shall befall you, he says, in the last days. And this is the first time that phrase appears in Scripture, where he says this is coming in the last days. This is not near-term wishful thinking. He's aware that this is a divine oracle. He's aware he's making a prophecy of things to come. He's aware that some of these things are going to come so far in the future they won't come until God comes and establishes his kingdom, in that eternal kingdom, things in the last days. That becomes a phrase associated with the Lord's return to establish his kingdom throughout the Old Testament and into the New. But it appears first here. Not only, there's another thing besides that's, I think, interesting. Turn to Isaiah. Keep your finger right here. We'll come right back. But go to Isaiah for just a moment. the second chapter. It might surprise you to know that in Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, this is the second time in these scriptures that the phrase "the last days" shows up. If you've got your finger in Genesis 49 and you look at how much of the Bible you've paged through to get to Isaiah chapter 2, without that phrase "the last days" showing up anywhere in there. When we get to Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, now it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob." I'm going to stop there simply to point out that in the last days, people will still be calling God the God of Jacob, who is the first one to use that phrase. And so he's referred to here as the God of Jacob. And I don't think that's coincidental. I think that's intentional. Anyway, Jacob has mentioned it here, and it gets mentioned again in Isaiah chapter 2 for the next time that it's used. So we know that when the Lord returns to establish his kingdom, this is not just having to do with Israel, but this has to do with us too. But when the Lord returns to establish his kingdom, we'll still be calling him the God of Jacob. Doesn't even use his God-given name Israel, but his birth name, Jacob, that uses there. Now, for the first set of messages we have for the sons of Leah, letter B, messages for the sons of Leah, verses 3 to 15. Let's look at verses 3 and 4 of Genesis 49. "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, uncontrolled as water. You shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." So for all of his priority as being his firstborn, he's unstable and will not excel. You say, well, water is very stable. It takes a lot to change it from, it doesn't take much but temperature to change it from a liquid to a solid or from a liquid to a gas, but it takes a lot to break it down into its chemical components. Nevertheless, the point is that water itself is not something that is easily tamed as a fluid. It's not safe, it's turbulent in stormy weather. And that's the point he's making. He's comparing him to dangerous, turbulent waters. And here, for the very first time in the biblical text, Jacob makes a public pronouncement. There's never been any evidence before that he's even aware, but here he publicly announces to his sons, his gathered sons, that he is aware of Reuben's attempt to disrupt Jacob's leadership, his father's leadership, by defiling his father's bed because of the affair that he had with the one of his wives, one of the handmaids, all right, Bilhah. Jacob knew of his sin. And for that treachery, he will not receive the birthright. You will not be preeminent because, he says, for that treachery, he will not receive the birthright. He won't even enjoy the respect of his brothers. Salehammer, in his commentary, says it this way. He says, Reuben no longer had the right of the firstborn of the household of Jacob because he violated the honor of his father, end quote. Now, his tribe will be the first to receive their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan in Numbers chapter 32. Yet they will also lose the respect of the nation when in the Canaanite wars in Judges 5, we're told, verses 15 and 16, when Deborah and Barak called for Israel to come to their aid, Reuben didn't show up. They didn't come. And as we studied the history of Israel in the Old Testament, when we went through there, it's been a long time, and it took us a long time to get through there, but his tribe never attained any position of influence in the nation. No one from the tribe of Reuben rose to prominence within the nation, anywhere in the biblical record. Next, Jacob addressed Simeon and Levi together. Back to Genesis 49 now, verses 5 through 7. Simeon and Levi, he says, are brothers. Well, of course, they're brothers. They're all brothers. But what he means by this here is both in parentage as well as in disposition, the way they think, the way they act. And what he says about them, that brothership, as it were, their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So I summarize this by saying Simeon and Levi are cruelly violent and willfully angry. They're cruelly violent. They have a history of cruel violence and willful anger. So they will be divided and scattered in Israel. They'll be divided and scattered in Israel. As a teacher, there's often two kids you do not want sitting side by side. Okay? The teachers are nodding and smiling because they know. You know it's trouble. I got two tenors side by side back here. I can't separate them. The choir. Sorry. Couldn't resist. Tonight's rehearsal. They earned it. Anyway, Jacob is saying to these boys, he says, look, the whole nation will suffer if you guys are together. And in fact, I'm going to scatter you through all of Israel, throughout Israel. Now, what's he referring to? The most obvious one is the murder of the Shechemites after their sister Dinah was taken by the son of the king of Shechem, whose name was Shechem. That he took Dinah and kept her and intended to keep her as a wife, but he treats her as property. And this is one of the most grievous of Jacob's failings in that he didn't do anything to defend her. But they took it on their own, on themselves to defend her. And they went in and they lied. They had men all got circumcised, and then they went in and killed them all. Right? And it was Simeon and Levi that engineered that and that were carrying the swords and all that. I suspect that includes a veiled reference to what I think was probably their leadership in the plot to kill Joseph. And I suspect that partly because of this statement, but partly because when Joseph, in the persona of Zaphnath-Paneah, as we covered when we were there not too long ago, when he accused them of being spies and he sends them all, says they can all go, but he's going to keep one of them, he keeps Simeon, the older of the two, there as a prisoner. I suspect that probably had something to do with it. Jacob mentions this here, and he wants nothing to do with their behavior. He doesn't want anything to do with their company. He pronounces a curse upon their cruel wrath. He wants to make sure that in the future they are not allowed to organize and get united in their efforts in the future, so they'll be divided in Jacob, scattered in Israel. Interestingly enough, this is one of those places where a prophecy is one of the few places where a prophecy is made. I was talking to Gary about this, that prophecy by its nature is difficult to predict exactly how it'll be fulfilled until after. It's something that once it's fulfilled, you say, oh, now I get it. And this is one of those. And I say that because in this particular case, you've got the same prophecy for the two of them. And it's fulfilled in different ways for each of them, but still fulfilled literally, but fulfilled differently. In the case of Simeon, he'll be given when the lots are cast by Jacob by Joshua, and the land is distributed in Joshua chapter 19. Simeon's inheritance is going to be within the territory of Judah. It'll be a portion carved out of the territory that's been allotted to Judah, and so he'll be surrounded by the tribe of Judah, Mostly, they'll be assimilated into Judah or scattered outside of Israel among the Edomites, the Amalekites, in 1 Chronicles chapter 4. Now, after the kingdom is divided, It's to their credit that many of the Simeonites that have located in northern Israel among the other tribes, many of them will defect from the northern kingdom and join Judah. Because you know, when the kingdom divides, it's Judah and Benjamin to the south that are beside by themselves. All the other tribes to the north are separated under Jeroboam. But many of the Simeonites, according to 2 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 9, many of the Simeonites will defect from the northern kingdom of Israel and rejoin Judah. They'll be absorbed into Judah there. As a tribe, they're virtually unidentifiable after King Asa. Completely impossible to find any reference to them after King Asa. So Simeon will be absorbed by Judah, and that will keep Simeon from causing a lot of trouble there. It's probably significant that it is Judah who will be the one responsible for Simeon. Levi, on the other hand, will assume responsibility for the priesthood. Levi will assume responsibility for the priesthood. The tribe of Levi is going to be scattered. They're not going to have a land of their own. They're going to have cities in each of the tribes, very literally scattered throughout Israel, as they'll have cities that are provided by each of the tribes, and they'll live throughout the land. Joshua 21 talks about that. They will serve a vital role in Israel's worship during the Old Testament period. In some ways, it's a promotion. It's a pretty significant one. And that'll happen because when Moses comes down from the mountain with the stone tablets of the law and sees the idolatry of the golden calf that Aaron has started by making the golden calf while he was away, he will call on Israel to help. Who will stand with me against this idolatry? And it will be his own tribe, the tribe of Levi, that will stand with him. Nobody else. And so he will punish them. Many of them will be killed. Many of the Israelites will be killed as they grind up the golden calf, make everybody drink it, mix it with the water and make them drink it. But it's not insignificant that the descendants of Levi, from this position of leadership in the priesthood, they will spend their entire history shedding blood, because they're responsible for killing the lambs for the sacrifices as a reminder of their own bloodthirstiness throughout their history. And so that's not insignificant. It's worth recognizing that. It's also worth noting that in his remarks about Simeon and Levi, Jacob here speaks in the first person as God when he says, "I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel," in verse 7. So he's closely identifying himself with God as he speaks here with divine authority. Next in line in this oracle is Judah, verses 8 to 12. "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have grown up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk." That's a lengthy prophecy concerning Judah. Trying to summarize that in a single statement, I said Judah is strong and courageous. Jacob describes him as strong and courageous and says he will be praised by his brothers. He'll be victorious over his enemies, and he will rule. Those are the primary points that Jacob is making in this prophecy. Some of the details are difficult to explain, and I'm not going to... I decided not to go dig too deep into all this, or I wouldn't have time to get all this done in one lesson. When he talks about the lion, he couches, he lies down as a lion who dares to rouse him up. The idea there is explained by Victor Hamilton. He says, the lion, having recently eaten, has retired to its sleeping quarters to digest its meal, and even while it is reposing, nothing else tries to invade its territory. So powerful is the lion. End quote. There's an interesting parallel that I think was consciously reminiscent of Joseph's dreams many years before. Remember Joseph's dreams? He dreamed that his brothers would bow down before him, and then he dreamed that his brothers and his mother and father would bow down before him. Jacob now says that Judah's brethren shall bow down before you. All right? To Judah, not Joseph. It's already happened in Joseph's case. That prophecy has been fulfilled. It's not a transfer of a prophecy that that was going to be fulfilled in somebody else. That prophecy has been fulfilled on a couple of occasions when they came to, three different occasions they bowed down before him. When they came down to appeal for the food twice, and when they moved there, so now Jacob is saying these several years later, it's 17 or 18 years after they've moved there, that he is now saying that to Judah that his brethren shall bow down before you. Now, that's the point he's making is that Joseph's ascendancy has been real and important, but it's been temporary. It's for this generation. There's coming a different ascendancy that will be to Judah, and Judah will become preeminent of all of his sons. There's the reference until Shiloh comes, that is, until he comes to whom it belongs, is essentially what that means. And so that's prophetic of the coming Christ. The prophecy will find its initial fulfillment, really, in David's coronation. That'll come about 640 years later, when David is crowned king. That'll be the first real evidence of the fulfillment of this prophecy for Judah. Because it looks like the kingship is going to a different tribe with Saul as king. I'll get to him in a minute. But it'll find its initial fulfillment at David's coronation. And from that point forward, Judean leadership will be maintained throughout Israel's history. I mean, even when the Babylonians come and sack Jerusalem and carry away everybody into captivity, who's the most prominent Israelite of that era? You know his name, Daniel. What tribe was Daniel from? Judah. Okay? So even then, Judean tribe is preeminent because Daniel was one of those that was of royalty that was taken away. I'm confident that he was a descendant of David. When Rome sacked Jerusalem hundreds of years after that in AD 70, it looked like the scepter fell from the hand of Judah at that point. And most historians would say that that's what happened. But that's to overlook the fact that what that actually seems to prove, kind of in a subtle way, it's an indirect proof that Messiah had already come and that Christ has taken up the scepter and that he now holds the scepter of authority from the right hand of the Father, from his place at the right hand of the Father. And he is now king. He just has not yet come to establish and assert his kingly authority. He's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, and he will return with that scepter. So it has not fallen. It has been elevated to heaven in the hand of Christ. He'd been identified as the coming king throughout the Gospel of Matthew, and the promise will see its ultimate fulfillment when Christ returns to come back as king. And it's not insignificant that in Revelation 5:5, when John first introduces Christ as the coming king, when he's revealed from heaven as coming with the scepter in his hand, he is called the Lion of Judah in Revelation 5:5, which is a reference to this prophecy right here. Now, concerning the next six sons, the last two of Leah's taken in reverse order and the four sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, there's really not much specific information in Genesis about their lives. We don't know a lot about them personally. So we can't base We don't have any basis to make assumptions about the reasons for the prophecies. Anything we would say would be guesswork. The next one mentioned here is Zebulun, and I don't know whether it's significant. I have no idea the significance, but he takes these two out of order, out of birth order. Issachar was born before Zebulun, but he takes Zebulun next, and then Issachar. No idea why, and so guessing is pointless. Zebulun's promise is difficult, frankly, because we don't know much about him, and it's hard to see how it has been fulfilled. Jacob says in verse 13, for Zebulun will dwell at the seashore. He shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall be toward Sidon. The problem with it is when the land is distributed by lot under Joshua, his territory is not a coastal one. He's not given coastal land. And his territory, said, would border Sidon, but the land apportioned to him doesn't really do that unless you consider Sidon as a part of Phoenicia at large, because it borders Phoenicia, but not the part that would be identifiable as Sidon. So it's hard to say. It should probably be understood as a promise of future conquest, of expansion, and of trade. Judges 1:30, Judges 5:18 hints at that. But I think I'm inclined to say that the best I can do on this is it may have to wait for Christ's return to be fulfilled literally. This is one of those prophecies that we don't have any evidence of its having been fulfilled literally yet, and is going to await Christ's return for a literal fulfillment. Issachar's promise isn't any easier. It's also difficult. Verses 14 and 15, Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. So I said Issachar's promise is also difficult. The prophecy concerning Issachar is usually understood, as I've stated first. It may mean he'll be strong and hardworking but unambitious. Kyle and Delitch, in their classic Old Testament, the Testament commentary, it's multi-volume set that has been translated from the original German. they say that he was content with, quote, material good and would rather submit to the yoke and be forced to do the work of a slave than to risk his possessions and his peace in the struggle for liberty, end quote. That's a fairly typical way for interpreting this, of interpreting this passage. But it may be more negative than it ought to be. I don't know for sure. In Judges chapter 5, verse 15, Deborah praises him in the victory song of Deborah and Barak. He's praised for his valiant contributions to their efforts to says the descendants of Issachar are praised. In Judges chapter 1, there's a list of the territories of the tribes that at that point had yet failed to drive out the Canaanites. It lists the tribe of Manasseh in verse 27, the tribe of Ephraim in verse 29, the tribe of Zebulun in verse 30, the tribe of Asher in verse 31, and the tribe of Naphtali in verse 33. Significantly, Issachar's tribal holdings were surrounded by all of those, but Issachar is not mentioned as having failed to drive out the Canaanites. The implication of their omission there is that they had, in fact, succeeded in driving out the Canaanites at that point. Therefore, for these reasons, Victor Hamilton argues that it may be better to translate, he retranslates that final clause, he became a servant or a slave at forced labor. He translates that as he became a farmer. He says that may be a better way to understand the Hebrew there instead of so negatively. And he argues that the prophecy means that he would not shy away from assuming tasks of some physical magnitude, end quote. So he gives it a much more favorable translation and interpretation. I don't know which is the best way to understand it. Issachar, for going forward, other than this statement here, the only other thing we really have about Issachar is his absence from that list in Judges chapter 1 and the praise for him in Judges chapter 5. So we don't see much. And so I'd probably be inclined to Hamilton's more positive interpretation there. In which case, letter B, I said it may mean that he would tackle physically daunting tasks. He would take things, he would work hard at things that other people would let go. Physically daunting tasks. That may be the better way to understand it. And now, I don't know if the brothers thought that maybe the sons of the handmaids would be left out of Jacob's estate, but Jacob moves on to them and includes them in his discussion of his prophetic oracle messages for the sons of the handmaids in verses 16 to 21. He starts with Dan in verses 16 and 17. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. Those two verses for Dan. The next one I think is an insertion. I just mean it's a parenthetical statement that's not a part of the oracle about the sons. Dan will judge his people. Does not mean that he would condemn them. Judge does not mean condemn. It means in this case that he would defend. He would plead their case. Or plead their cause. There's a sense in which this is fulfilled in Samson, who was from Dan. Samson was from the tribe of Dan. At least to a degree, it has a partial fulfillment in him. It's a little more difficult to interpret the imagery of being a serpent lying by the wayside to cause destruction by biting at a horse's heels. Interpreting it negatively, here Hamilton is negative, where he was positive in terms of Issachar. He suggested it means that Dan, though small, will be quite capable of holding his own. His strength will be greater than his size. Excuse me. He's interpreting it positively. I said that backwards. That Dan, though small, will be quite capable of holding his own. His strength will be greater than his size. End quote. Henry Morris has a similar comment on this. He says, quote, while apparently unimpressive, Dan nevertheless was a dangerous adversary, well able to protect Israel's northern boundary against invaders. End quote. On the other hand, others have taken it more negatively, largely because some of the things that we do know about Dan in Judges chapter 18, verses 30 and 31, idolatry is officially introduced into the land of Israel through the Danites. They're the first ones to go into idolatry and to establish it as a tribal religion. This is before Jeroboam and so on. And that happens in Judges chapter 18. Later, when Jeroboam rebelled against the Judean king Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and the kingdom split, Jeroboam sets up two golden calves to worship for Israel, for the northern tribe of Israel, northern kingdom of Israel. One of them is stationed at the north in the tribe of Dan. Because of this, Henry Morris also suggests that this may be why Dan is not listed among the tribes in Revelation 7, verses 4 through 8, when we get a list of the tribes that are going to be restored to their land in Revelation. Dan is not listed. And it may be because of their history of idolatry, their early history of idolatry, and the corruption of the people of Israel as a result. Now, the particular prophecies concerning each of his sons is now interrupted briefly, with an interlude of confident praise in verse 18. I think I included that in the outline without a note, without a number there beside it, right? Because I'm numbering the sons. An interlude of confident praise. His exclamation, "For your salvation I wait, O Lord." It breaks in following his remarks about Dan. And it may be significant that it follows Dan because of the coming idolatry that Dan would introduce. Jacob's expressing his confidence, the protection and deliverance that's going to ultimately come. It's significant that this is the first use of the word salvation in Scripture. Anywhere in the Bible, the Hebrew word here is Yeshua, which is also significant. Yeshua. If you transliterate that word into Greek and then think of it as a proper name, it becomes Jesus. Maybe understanding more than we realize, Jacob could be indicating that his expected salvation would come through a person that he's awaiting, the one that God had promised in Genesis 3:19. That expected salvation that we could understand, we could, in fact, translate this, "I have waited for your Jesus, O Lord." That would be a legitimate translation of this, because all it is to take Yeshua as a proper name and transliterate it to Greek. Having made that exclamation in the middle of this oracle concerning the future of his sons, he then moves on, picks up where he left off. Gad, he says in verse 19, as for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he will raid at their heels. The implication is generally understood is that Gad would be overcome by raiders, but he will overcome at the end. It would not be a permanent defeat. Gad's territory is going to be located on the east of Jordan. It will be vulnerable to attack, particularly by the Ammonites. Judges 11 and 12 tells us about that. Early in their history, Deborah has rebuked them for failing to come to the aid of their brethren on the west of Jordan, just like the Reubenites hadn't showed up in Judges chapter 5, verse 17. Later, though, in 1 Chronicles 5, 18, they are praised for their valiance. They're compared to lions in their fighting ferocity in 2 Chronicles 12, verses 8 to 15. The implication is they'll often be overrun, but they will in the end be victorious. Asher, whose name means blessedness or happiness, in verse 20, as for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he will yield royal dainties. Basically, I think he's promising Asher agricultural bounty. He'll be allotted one of the most fertile parts of Canaan. The land that Asher will be given through Joshua's oversight anyway, with the drawing of the lots, will abound with wheat and oil. It'll have so much of it that Solomon will call upon Asher for the supplies that he needs for the household of King Hiram in 1 Kings chapter 5. Jacob is probably promising that Asher will be blessed by God with abundance and with prosperity, and he'll produce food that is luxuriant and rich enough for royalty to help to feed kings. Which is a pretty substantial yet material promise for Asher. Verse 21, Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. The simplest explanation for the prophecy for Naphtali is that it was a prophecy would be swift and successful in battle. I think I left off the last three letters of the word successful in the outline. He'll be swift and successful in battle and eloquent in song. We don't have a whole lot of information about Naphtali in the Old Testament. The most distinguished future descendant of Naphtali is Barak, who was working with Deborah in Judges chapter 4, verses 6 and 15. And if we assume that the victory song of Deborah and Barak was maybe written by Barak, it would be an example of his eloquence that is mentioned here. That's possible. Now, his final prophetic words are addressed to the sons of Rachel. And he addresses Joseph first. The messages for the sons of Rachel, letter D. It says, Joseph will be fruitful, but hated. Look at verses 22 to 26. He is a fruitful bough, by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him. But his bow remained firm. His arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Wow, those high-sounding words. He'll be fruitful, but he'll be hated, but he'll be made strong by God. And a lot of this is stated in the past tense because the initial reference is already fulfilled. His fruitfulness is already fulfilled. He has two sons who are going to have tribes of their own with other sons that are going to be blessed under the rubric of the older brothers. These two sons will share in have full shares of Jacob's estate as if they were Jacob's own sons. that he's hated and wounded by archers has already been at least partially fulfilled in the treatment of his brothers. They sold him into slavery. Potiphar's wife had him imprisoned on false charges. Yet he'd been made strong by the mighty one of Jacob in verse 24. We see Jacob's confidence in God, in the way he speaks of the Lord. He calls him mighty. He points to his strength. He calls him the shepherd, referring to his tender provision. He calls him the rock, referring to steadfast reliability. But he doesn't stop with that. He goes on to call him the God of your father who helps you, the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, and so on. The fulfillment of this is seen in the prosperity and the prominence of the two tribes of his sons from whom come some of Israel's greatest future leaders. From the tribe of Ephraim, most notably, comes Joshua. But then comes Deborah and Samuel and Jeroboam. And for all his rebellion, he becomes a powerful leader. From the tribe of Manasseh come the two judges, two of the judges that we know well, Gideon and Jephthah, come from the tribe of Manasseh. Jacob's final prophetic words, remarks, are reserved for Benjamin. And it's a less glowing portrait than we have of Joseph. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, he devours the prey, and in the evening, he divides the spoil. Not exactly sure how best to understand that. A ravenous wolf which devours the prey in the morning, divides the spoil at night, verse 27. Now, at times, that warlike quality for Benjamin will be manifested positively, and other times manifested negatively. Early in the period of the judges, Ehud, one of the earliest of the judges, will rescue the nation from the Moabite oppression by driving a dagger through the belly of the Moabite king. And Ehud comes from the tribe of Benjamin. Later, remember that he did that because he managed to sneak his dagger in and kill Eglon because he was left-handed. All right. There will later be a group of men who were expert at slinging a stone with either the right hand or their left hand. They could sling it at a hair's breadth and not miss. The scripture says. Left hand. I don't know that it has anything to do with anything, but every person in Scripture ever identified as left-handed comes from the tribe of Benjamin. I don't know why, but it's interesting that Benjamin's name means son of my right hand. Okay, I just find that fascinating. Okay, trivial things fascinate me, sorry. But I don't have any explanation for that. Nevertheless, coming back to Benjamin and what we do know about him, besides that with Ehud in Judges chapter 3, later on in Judges, their behavior is despicable in regard to the way they rape and dismember the Levite's concubine, and they end up inciting a civil war. In that conflict, they hold their own for a while, but end up almost being annihilated and disappearing altogether as a tribe. Later still, that's in Judges 19 and 20. The warriors and archers that were so famous were mentioned in 1 Chronicles 8:40 and 12:2. The most prominent of the Benjamites, though, will be Saul, the first king of Israel, in 1 Samuel 9:1. And it will look like Benjamin's going to gain the ascendancy instead of Judah. But Saul will never be permitted a dynasty. His son will never reign. Because Saul will be proven to be not the kind of king God intended. And God will appoint David through prophet Samuel. Saul will start out as a valiant warrior, but his end will be inglorious. Significantly, quote Henry Morris here, quote, Jacob's blessings centered especially on Joseph and Judah, and only physical blessings were promised Joseph, whereas the spiritual blessings of being the ancestor of Messiah was promised Judah, in addition to the physical blessing and political leadership. End quote. In the future of Jacob's sons, Joseph's descendants will dominate during the early period of the conquest and the judges. Benjamin will dominate briefly under Ehud and later under Saul. But ultimate political and spiritual ascendancy will go to Judah. And so that's the takeaway from the prophecy concerning Jacob's two sons through Rachel. Now, precisely how those will be fulfilled in the future kingdom is impossible to say, but we do know that the ultimate king, the one who will rule forever, descends from what tribe? Judah, right? He comes from Judah, not from Joseph, not from either of the tribes of Joseph. Jacob's last words then, verses 28 to 33, and I'll wrap this up. And these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father had said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, every one, with the blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So Jacob's last words. First of all, Jacob's family emphasis. I think it's interesting here that he identifies these sons that he's just given. Now, it's stated in the third person here, but they're identified as the 12 tribes of Israel. I think it's interesting they're already thinking of his sons as families and their families as tribes within the larger nation of Israel. This is the first reference to them as such. Second, he included all 12 sons in his blessing. Yeah, granted, some of the statements don't sound particularly positive, particularly blessed, but he asserts that all of them have received what is appropriate to the individual. Jacob wants his sons to understand they're all participants in God's prophetic future, whatever that may be, whatever role they will have, they're all participants in God's prophetic future. He has a role for each of them in the future. Isaac, a generation before, had tried to give the entire blessing to Esau and leave Jacob out when Jacob had been the God-intended recipient. Now, There's no son that's going to be left out, and Jacob makes sure that that's communicated to all of them together in their presence. They'll not share equally. Joseph and Judah have received the broadest promises, but all of them will participate. And then Jacob's final charge is to bury him in Canaan. Final charge to bury him in Canaan. Before wrapping up this family meeting and then curling up and dying, Jacob repeats for all his sons a charge. He'd earlier issued this charge to Joseph in the previous chapter. It may be that when Joseph promised to do this, he spoke more for Egypt than speaking for the family, that he promised to take his father back and have him buried there. I don't know. But I don't think it's that Jacob doesn't trust Joseph to keep his promise. Jacob wants a commitment from all of his sons. He wants all of them to know this is his last wish. He wants them to receive his burial instructions from him, not to have to take Joseph's word. Well, Dad told me this is what he wants, right? And again, that's a good way to start a fight in an estate lawyer's office. Well, Dad told me this is what he wants. Dad should have spelled it out. Well, Dad did spell it out now in everybody's presence, so there would be no confusion. First of all, he anticipates his death and his future resurrection. He anticipates both his death and his future resurrection. He says he's going to be gathered unto my people. I love that phrase. He tells his sons that he expects them to bury him in Canaan. So to all succeeding generations, it would be a testimony of his faith and the faith of his forebears, Isaac and Abraham, so that everybody will remember that I believed we would inherit this land. Even now, I don't know how long it's going to be before we get there, but I want you to promise to bury me there when you go. He has no idea it's going to be over 400 years. But he knows it's going to take a while because they're going to grow into a nation before they go. I think it's also interesting. So he expects his burial to be a testimony of his faith. Number two. I think it's intriguing that at some point, since he had come back to Canaan from the home of Laban, his father-in-law, bringing his family to settle there and having Rachel die along the way, he seems to have decided that he may have been wrong to favor Rachel. Because if you'll recall, Rachel was buried under the oak tree outside Bethlehem. But he says here, it was Leah that he buried in the family burial plot, where his father and his wife, his father and mother, and his grandfather and grandmother had been buried together. And it's with Leah that he intends to be buried. He was permanently interred in a grave he shared with Leah, not with Rachel. Perhaps more importantly, he wants his sons to remember the significance of the land that God had promised to them. They were going to be in Egypt. They'll have many prosperous years in Egypt, and it may make them less than eager to go home. I mean, keep in mind that after the Babylonian captivity, it lasted 70 years, and it came time to go back, and they got a decree from Cyrus of Persia that they could go back. It was less than 1% of the population that actually got up and left and went back. The rest of them stayed because they'd been there for 70 years, a couple of generations. They'd gotten comfortable. They're going to be here for 400 years. He didn't want any of them staying behind. He didn't want any of them thinking of Egypt as their home. They need to remember Egypt is not their home. There's a land God promised you to you. You must return to that land, and God will one day take you there. That's what Jacob is driving home to them. He's made his intentions clear of what he wants to be done, and he lies down then and dies. And we see that phrase again. It had been stated at Genesis 25, verse 8, when Abraham died, at Genesis 25, verse 17, when Ishmael died, at Genesis 35, verse 29, when Isaac died, and now the fulfillment here of Jacob's expectation, he was gathered to his people. And that has nothing to do with him being buried in the family burial ground. That's not going to happen yet. It'll happen soon, but not yet. It'll happen in the next chapter. It refers to his continued existence after death in the presence of those ancestors who died before him with the glorious welcome home that he experienced in their presence. That's why we sang the songs about welcome home tonight, because Jacob was anticipating that welcome home. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word.